Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the August 2022 Poet Radio program on WGXC. My name is Chris, and I've been hosting this program since 2015. Today, I'm lucky to have with me and be with a poet, Ben Friedlander, and Ben and I are currently in Owl's Head, Maine, recording remotely. Ben is a professor at the University of Maine, and we've been visiting with each other in Maine for over two decades, as it turns out, and we're on the coast above Penobscot Bay. I started to get to know Ben before I even knew him personally. He was a student at University of California in Berkeley. I saw Ben do a poetry reading with August Kleinzahler and Tom Gunn in 1987. We may have been at a party together after that, but he really came on my radar about 3 or 4 years later when Nathaniel Mackey told me that when I said I was going to go to school in Albany, he said, oh, Ben Friedlander is going to Buffalo. You definitely need to know Ben, because Ben had been working in Berkeley with an interesting group of people, including Andrew Schelling on a publication of Jimmy and Lucy's House of K. He worked with poet Larry Eigner on editing Larry's poems. So I didn't know Ben. I knew a little of his work. And then sure enough, he was in Buffalo. I was in Albany. There were events such as the poetry and from the New Coast. And I believe that's where I actually met Ben, was at the New Coast Festival. And since then, we discovered Nate was right. We had a bunch of crossover. We did this punk online publication very early, even before the web, Descriptions of an Imaginary Universe, and which got us in a bit of trouble, as I recall. Why? Because we did a critical poetry publication without any real names being attached to the writing. So as you can tell, Ben and I do go back pretty far, and we did a radio program once upon a time on WRPI in the mid-90s, I'm going to guess 95 or 96, and we were playing rock records and obscure things like the Insect Surfers, I think, and interspersing that with Ben's poetry. So I'm glad to be with Ben. And he was just telling me a few minutes ago that he hadn't had been able to do a lot of readings during the pandemic, and that he would be reading many of these poems for the first time. So that's very exciting to me. How'd I do on the intro, Ben? Is there anything else I need to say?
That's pretty succinct, given how much history we have.
We've been giving things to each other on and off for years. The last time I saw Ben was just before the pandemic, and he gave me a Kathy Acker chapbook that was an incredible little thing. I don't know, you had a few of them, actually.
From Theodore Anslin's library that had been with a friend of mine here in Maine, Kristen Case. Kristen had been invited by Anslin's widow to come pick books out of his library that she had no place to dispose of. So we drove up to Cherryville and filled a couple of boxes with some beautiful, incredible things.
I look forward to talking with you about various endeavors of yours and poems and poetry. Well, why don't we get things going with a little poetry?
Sure. So you had mentioned when you emailed me about possible things to talk about. One was just, you know, what was going on during the pandemic. So I thought I'd read some of the poems that I wrote over the last few years that came out of that, and maybe preface it by saying I went through a long period of not writing at all. My father had a massive stroke, and I spent a lot of time overseeing his care in nursing home, and I guess just the general way life develops as you get older. Just went through a period of darkness and non-writing. And maybe a year before the pandemic, I came out of that and started writing again, and actually quite a bit since then. So I've been writing these poems that I think of as C-notes, because they're all 100 words long. I tend to rely on constraints like that. And this one is a very relaxed one because I don't count words that are crossed out or that are printed in a lighter ink. So it's just a little bit of a sort of a guardrail for me as I work my way through the fog of trying to figure out what it is I have to say. So these are from a book that I'm trying to finish now that I've been calling Interregnum, because it feels like these have been between years. And I know what came before, but what comes after, I don't know. So I'll read a few of those and then we can chat. This is called End of a Certain Thing. Succumbing to denial, I denied that I was cut. I was not injured, only pruned. I was unblankable. I'm stumped. What I know is chopped down, burnt, leaving a knee-high portion of the trunk firmly rooted in before. To be many with all things, not one, no, never one with all things, only one of many. My face entirely outward, even alone. My smile, a wandering light caught on the curvature of a mouth. Earth advances in the dark upon the sun. Daylight, breaking free, whispers warning. I reached back for words to steady me, but the ground was slippery. I couldn't keep hold. To be one with all things is to be a fraction. Many with all means overflowing. Won't form a more perfect union than this loose-fitting uniformity of grief. When thoughts are grasped with calloused words, a rough understanding scratches the surface. Thursday's red and Friday's blue both look purple in Saturday's light. Friday's blue and Saturday's yellow both look green on Sunday. Lockdown. Life goes forward when your path is blocked by you. Self-contained, I'm self-contained by multitudes of tasks that break apart the day. The nights make do with fixed length by varying intensity. When my eyes are tired, objects cede their edges to a blur, nibbling at reality as money does, the creature of a dream who outran sleep. Dream. A day so saturated in light, each hour seems almost to singe the edge of evening, curling red at the horizon. I pump my wings all the faster, but I am still in this moment, not the next.
That does remind me of the lockdown part of the pandemic. Very good.
And so this one is, by my counts, is five poems, and I've divided them, but it's a longer sequence. It kind of charts just, I think you'll hear it, just some of the things that we've all been passing through. It's called How It Is Here. Since we can't destroy the pedestal, we knock its statue down, and that's enough for now. Floating between inapt and inopportune, the days deflate. Disappointment, like sleep in our eyes when we wake, replaces the story that produced it, like a question back-engineered from an answer no one understood. The mind is an all. It adds another hole to the belt when life grows thin. If we hold our tongues, it's not to keep silent, but the way one holds a frightened child's hand walking over a bridge, the water noisy, showing froth between slats. 2. Thaw rushing, startle coloration, a spider wrapping a beetle in a web, dualism reduced to oppressive unity, hollow space within stuffed with years like insulation, dragged through a sieve against our will, each hole a blank we cease to apprehend, crow forcing an eagle from its territory. Time, like wind, carries off this desiccated leaf. Moon rising high, we falling low. The cardboard cutout world we stand beside for our souvenir picture. Slowly pulling packing tape from a mood, which isn't improved, but does stand revealed. Minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, accumulating like debt we choose not to honor. 3. My eyes won't stay open. They flutter and yield way. Sleep enters and goes where? Unnoticed, yet disturbing my night, consciousness never ends, it only subsides. Never at rest, a sea that creeps up and overtakes the beach, then recedes. I don't think I know what I think I don't know thinks of whatever, cold, very cold. What sinks to the bottom of thought? Words, can you feel your way there? Life, an imperfect circle, rounds the corner, hugs the peg that merely describes the circumstance it embodies. A footstep, large enough to get lost in, a hole, gaping. 4. The order came from above that life was normal again, but the sound was out of sync with the lips. The evidence of things unseen unnerved the worm I am, cut in two. One half regenerated, the other died. And so my thought proved partial in its ability to go on. Words came to mind, disintegrated, slipped from consciousness. I tried to hold on to them, tried to remember things I should ask of people now dead. Envied the sun its yellow, sky its blue, and wondered why they never blur, save in the plant that yields their green. 5. Along a path hemmed in by tall grass, crossing through private property, so much already irrecoverable in this unsound principality built from a population in flux. Patterns of isolated instance, temporary, unprotected. What we can't say stands to reason, unable even to taunt from a distance. Radio signal flickering into hearing now and then, dying. Insentient, but mobilized by forces larger than themselves, the raindrops form a sea that ebbs and flows according to the hour. All that is measures time. Aware of each clumsy mistake, we pick our way through, never prepared for what's coming or missing it.
One of the things I was planning to ask you about or talk with you about during the show is pandemic experience, but I feel like I don't even, we don't have to do that almost because of the poems you just have read. I mean, they're very, they seem so necessary or something. They seem like they had to be written. I don't know why. I mean, I do remember when we were in graduate school and I was having trouble keeping up my sort of poetry game because of all the other work we had to do. And you're like, doing poetry is the thing that keeps me sane during all the other academic gobbledygook that we do. So I was wondering, maybe the pandemic, you had these poems had to be written just because of the situation we were in, kind of. I mean, then what they felt, there was an urgency to them in a way, a personal urgency.
That's interesting. I mean, what was unnerving to me in those years when I wasn't really writing was, it wasn't really that I wasn't writing, because I've just constantly filling up cards and scraps of paper with words and phrases and, you know, maybe as many as 20 words at a time. And I've never been able to sit down and write a poem, you know, have an idea, this is the subject, and write from beginning to end. It's always been suturing things together from scraps written sometimes 10 years apart, sometimes all within a single day.
Interesting.
And so for this period when I was, you know, especially when I was in the nursing home, I just did not have the mental energy where I was able to, the power of imagination that it takes for me, at least, to look at, you know, 15 different scraps and figure out what belongs, what doesn't, what order they go in. And so it was ironic almost to feel like a return of this energy right at the time that the world was closing down. Mm. But I guess it made it possible for me during the pandemic to really use that energy and focus, because there wasn't as much distraction as there had been for a while.
Sure. It's almost, what you're describing almost seems like a modular process to the way you compose. And I really don't know if I was aware of that before.
I kind of take pride in writing a poem where it doesn't sound that way. So I always want it to be constructed so that there's a flow. It's either musical or narrative in some way, but it's constructed. It's not the way it comes out.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you about the C note as a form? Because that's interesting to me, but it seems almost, arbitrary. I mean, how do you don't count words, but they're all about 100 words, or you do count words.
Yeah. Well, I count them because, you know, the one, I mean, I can show you, you know, so that they have things crossed out and things in gray ink, but everything else, you know, the titles and everything is 100. It is arbitrary and it's silly. The previous book I did, so I, you know, I haven't had a book since 2012, but my Etudes was kind of a ridiculous project where I wrote, so it was 100 poems. Each one was written in 3-word lines, 3 lines to a stanza, 3 stanzas to a page, 300 pages, including titles, epigraphs, dedications, and the numbering of each of the poems. And it was a real OCD kind of project because, you know, as I would tinker with the poem, if I would take out a "the," I would have to relineate the entire text. It was insane. And it was also arbitrarily chosen, but I liked it for a number of reasons, but one was I liked the idea of like making a book that was like a box in which everything was tightly packed together and you could take out each of the poems and sort of unwrap it from that form. So it included poems where there was a rhyme scheme and a rhythm that wasn't the 3-word line, so that there was sort of the static between the imposed form and the form that you would hear if I were to read it out loud. And it was very involved. That's the kind of energy that sort of it takes for me to put things together. And so when I started writing again, I wanted to do something that had a constraint because it gives me a way of knowing when something, it gives me a sense of, I guess it's like when you're swimming laps in a pool, it's like good to know that there's a wall coming and you're going to turn around. It's like it gave me something solid because if you're not writing poems that are metrically regular, you know, and anything goes, that can feel a little bit like there's no gravity and you're just afloat. Right. So even if it's arbitrary and kind of meaningless and invisible to a reader, it's helpful in composition. So I wanted that, but I also didn't want something that was going to require that kind of intense energy and focus and cleverness to accomplish because I didn't know if my focus was going to disappear again. I mean, you know, because in addition to, you know, just passing through this period of life changes, it's also, you know, you reach a certain age, you don't know if it's going to be there forever. So, you know, because I'm in my 60s now and I can definitely feel the differences in terms of mental ability from when I was in my 20s. I mean, you must know this feeling too, the frustration that you know so much more, but your ability to use it is increasingly less.
Yeah, sure. The body certainly slow down. You can't stay up all night anymore and these things. I think writing with constraint is good. Now, are you writing these on the computer or do you write them? I mean, you say you have, when does the C note actually come into being? Is that when you have your word count or you can see it on the software?
Oh, yeah.
Or?
I mean, I could show you, you know, I mostly write on index cards these days. I don't know why it's that mostly.
No, I know that from, by the way, listeners, Ben has a Instagram feed, which is, you know, very, to me, poetic and provocative, and you know, things I want to talk with him about. Many of them are stem from his Instagram posts. So I do see pictures of like 3x5 cards and
yeah. And so whatnot. It's a great form. But like with my notebook, you know, so I just, you know, things that come to mind, words and sentences, and I will sometimes count the individual, you know, 10 words here and 10 there. So at least I know what the amount is later.
It's interesting.
But just some, you know, one weekend or one day I'll sit down and I'll just go through and pull things out. At some point I'll type them up and I'll have them on the computer and I'll print them out and I'll, you know, I mean, it.
We were talking about the strike through and the gray, the grayscale or lighter text.
Yeah.
So that happens on the computer.
Exactly.
Right.
And, yeah.
And the word, the computer, I mean, you know, I'm always looking for ways in which writers are making use of the computer towards their own creativity,
right?
And using the computer creatively. You know, so this is something understandable. Like, you know, with all the interest I've had in digital writing over the years, you begin to realize that it's actually all digital writing. All the publishers are using software. All
right.
The poets are using software. And it may not be algorithmically influenced and all this, but still, maybe with your process, it seems like you have the analog side and then maybe the digital side.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the important thing is that it's not distinct. It's a lot of different kinds of practices that have to come together for the poem to take to take a shape where it feels shareable to me. I mean, I do have a sense of wanting to have it be carefully crafted so that, I mean, I think of myself as a recovering child of the New Criticism in the sense that, you know, my introduction to poetry in high school came by way of teachers who were trained in that. And so my earliest understanding of what a poem is that it's a text in which every word, even every syllable of a word, contributes to the overall effect or the meaning, and which is a kind of a beautiful conception of value in language. Mm-hmm. And it relates also to the modernist idea of the poem as a machine made of words.
And pound.
Exactly. And I think that it produces good work, but it doesn't lend itself to other values that are equally important for poetry, like fluidity, improvisation. Mm. And I've always had to struggle to write something that's longer than, you know, I could start with a page and whittle it down to 10 perfect words, but there are things that 10 words can't do. And I felt really trapped by that already, you know, by the end of the 90s. I felt like I'd reached the limit of what I could do with this honed, everything extraneous removed kind of writing. For me, FLARF was really useful because it just freed me from caring, because it was a poetry in which you were both using collage elements and also trying to write things that were purposefully bad and bad in ways that were mostly funny, but also ingenious and surprising. And so that sort of was the first time that I was able to break beyond the limits of what my craft could account for, in which everything had to be accounted for. And so building on that in this modular way, I've just tried to push beyond the epigrammatic quality that I think I tend to fall into. But I can only do that by relaxing an idea of craft, and then, but in the process of revision, sort of returning to it, relaxing it, returning to it. It's a very, I guess that's why, you know, even at this very late date in my writing life, I feel like I don't have a tried and true method that I can rely on, that I can just, okay, I figured out what a poem is and now I can just write them. It seems like it's always a struggle to get it to a point where I feel like I can share it with someone.
Hmm. I would say, just on the basis of this conversation and seeing some of the papers lying around on the table, I mean, this is a classic approach to poetry. I mean, this is not futuristic and out there. This is sort of old school, certainly value, and that's cool. And I should have mentioned in introducing you that you were part of the FLARF collective way back. How could I forget? I mean, I had Brandon Downing on the program last month, and I've had Nada and Sharon on the program before. So, I mean, interesting that poets from all sorts of styles and backgrounds and interests have made it into that grouping. And,
definitely.
And then how it came together, and then poof.
Yeah, that's a different conversation.
Yeah. But,
I mean, I got grandfathered in because of the work actually that we had done together doing descriptions of an imaginary universe and some of the digital experiments with anonymity and playing with style, so that I joined the group, I think, kind of late in the game, but it was really important for me.
Yeah, liberating for, I think, anybody. But, you know, one of the things that happened, and I don't have any data to back this up, was that many poets and writers started using these techniques and discovered that they were expansive for their own craft. Forget FLARF. I'm not a FLARFist, but I can do this too. And all of a sudden finding, you know, sort of new angles to write into or to supplement from the own individual imagination or whatever you want to call it. So that was interesting. Interesting sort of flash that actually, you know, people noticed. They can't argue that.
Yeah, I agree.
With a C note, I love it when any writer makes up their own form and names it. I love that. And those lines, the line about the worm, wow. I mean, I think a lot of people would actually, yeah, I was cut in half. This thing did separate us and I did stay alive. But then part of me or maybe things in my life didn't make it through, you know. The poems, your pandemic poems, your lockdown poems it's what I wanted to hear. It's so great.
I'm glad to hear that.
No, I'm glad you were writing during that time, you know, and glad now to finally be hearing it. I'm glad there's an opportunity to hear it, for sure. So what else did you pull out for the show?
Do you want to talk about Rosa Auslander a little bit?
Well, we can do that. I would like to.
We could talk about anything.
Well, like I was saying,
we got a lot we could pull on.
Let's talk about Rose Auslander. Is that how you say it?
Auslander?
Auslander. This is a poet that I know nothing about, essentially. It's never been presented to me in any kind of formal context, but I started to discover through Ben's social media feed. And they're usually very brief, sort of very succinct things, and sometimes he writes them out in his own hand. I thought it was maybe another pseudonym, honestly. I was not aware that this is a real, quote-unquote, real poet for a long time. And you do things like almost color code these poems sometimes. So I don't know how many of our listeners of the program are familiar with Rose Auslander, so edify us.
Yeah, she's a poet that I enjoy quite a bit. I mean, as background for her, so she was born in the same town in what is now Romania as Paul Celan. And in fact, they knew each other either there or either before the war or after. I can't remember the details of that. She's a little bit older than he is. She published her first book of poetry. She wrote in German. She published her first book, you know, right on the eve of World War II. Not a great time for a Jewish poet to make her literary debut. And she lived in New York. I think she was in New York in the 20s and then went back to take care of her mother and then got caught in the occupation. And then after the war, she went to New York and lived for a while. And she even wrote for a while in English. She had a connection with Marianne Moore, who supported her a little bit, and then finally went back to Germany. And so she published her first book in 1939 and then her second book not until 1966. I'm going in, this is the professorial side of me, just going into too much detail. She had this very late blooming period in the 70s where suddenly she started publishing almost a book a year and the poems shifted quite a bit. So after the 60s, she began writing these very short poems, usually just a couple of words in a line, usually less than a page long. And I think they must have been very improvisational, partly because of how many she wrote, and also because I gather the quality varied quite a bit. I have a friend, Leslie Morris, who's actually I met through Maria Damon, teaches in Minnesota, who's written about Rosa Auslander, and she told me she herself, you know, doesn't really like much of her poems, but she's been liking my translations partly because I've just been picking out the things that appeal to me, and so I think she's a poet that really benefits from selection. Hmm. Towards the end of her life, when she was very old, she had arthritis. She could no longer write any longer. And so she actually dictated her last few books. And those are mostly the ones that I've been working from. And I started doing it because, you know, just frankly, her German is so simple that it's easy for me to read. And, you know, I studied it for 2 years in college and did not do very well at all. My father was a native speaker of German, and before his stroke, I used to call him up with questions about German when I was trying to translate Paul Celan and Nelly Zox and other poets who are much more difficult. And, you know, we had this little routine we'd always go through where I would read him the line that I wanted, you know, some help with, and he would always say, what language are you speaking? You know, he liked to say, tell me that my pronunciation was so horrible he couldn't even tell if it was German or not. And so almost as an irony, after he had his stroke and he was in the nursing home, I got some of Rosa Auslander's books so that I could read to him in German, partly to practice my German and partly so he could, you know, have something to hear. And I started to translate them. They're short and they're simple. And so, you know, in the morning with my coffee, I'll sometimes pick one out of the book and just, you know, give a try at it. So, you know, I could read a couple of them.
And have these poems been translated by others as well, or?
Surprisingly, very little has been translated. There's one book that I have a hold of that's, you know, maybe 60 poems, which, you know, she must have written. I mean, I have her 14 volumes of paper, collected paperbacks, and it's, you know, it's, there's a lot there. I mean, I'm going to guess she has double the number of poems that Emily Dickinson wrote, something like that.
Well, let's hear some of your, I don't know if you want to read in the original and the translation or just the...
You know, I didn't even bring the German. I meant to, and I forgot. Oh, so I just right. have the English.
All right.
But my, you know, my German is so bad, it would be inflicting it on your...
All right, all right.
So, and actually, I just pulled out the, you know, this isn't by any means all of them. So, all right, this one's called A Bit Further. And this is actually kind of a long one for her, of the ones that I've been translating. A Bit Further. We are a bit further along in the time that denies us. Trees, the old friends, know us. Also wind says sometimes yes to our direction. We don't let ourselves be intimidated by strict prohibitions and shouts. A hurricane throws us to the floor. A hand of sun lifts us up. We dream in the heart of the future.
Very nice.
Salt. Truth seasoned with a grain of salt. Tears, salt of grief. Salt of the earth cradled by rocking water. Mother sea, salt anointed. Yeah, I don't really have many. Okay, I guess just one other. This one's called Scar. I should have brought more. When the day is scarred, break open the wounds of night. Star falls, stitch the dream that catches what falls in its lap. The dream falls in my lap before sleep surprises me and the night scars.
Oh.
You know, she was a survivor. And
right, that comes through.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's metaphysical. She writes with a very small vocabulary that repeats again and again. So she reminds me a lot of, like, Larry Eigner, you know, with a different tone and mood to her work. Very sort of existential kinds of questioning.
And what about the color coding? Is that just something just decorative that you like to do?
Yeah. Just, you know, the poems are short. I'll write them out on a piece of paper and then just with colored pencils, color over them. I don't know what it is. I mean, I've been reading a lot of Japanese and Chinese poetry in the morning and reading a little bit about the calligraphy tradition that's so intertwined with that poetry. And I'm attracted to the idea of calligraphy, but I have neither the skills nor, I think, the patience for that kind of work. So I do think now and again of ways to do something in manuscript that would be true to the kind of poetry I write or the kind of poetry that interests me that would be not calligraphy and not beautiful and not crafted. You know, I feel like enough of that in the composition, but that would somehow express some feeling about the work. So that was one example of that.
It's just like a sort of a personal embellishment. To, I mean, especially if it's your translation. I mean, you know, why not? I appreciate it. You know, it gives the reader something to consider, whether it's profound or not. It doesn't even matter. It's just like, okay, well,
yeah.
And you know, who needs just another word written on a piece of white paper?
Why not? It is
like, gussy it up a little bit.
Exactly. I, you know, I do a lot of underlining as I read, and I have colored pencils, and if I take pictures of something that I've been reading and marked up and put it on Instagram, I always will get asked, you know, so what are the colors, you know, like it's systematic, and it's like,
it's
just, you know, partly it's if you do everything in the same color, then it's as if everything is underlined, so it sort of lets things stand out, but there is no...
Well, some of the highlighting, you know, you highlight because it's something interesting you want to go back to. I can tell that. But with your,
sure.
In your case, it is excessive. And then you know, you have to decode it or not.
I mean, a book is a notebook. This is something I learned from Cass Clark that she told me that John Clark learned from Charles Olson, which is that you treat your books like a notebook. And that's part of the process, both of understanding what you're reading, but also generating new writing of your own. Mm-hmm. It took me decades to get over my anxiety about, desecrating books. And for a long while, I would buy two copies of a book that meant something to me so I could have a clean one.
Oh, really?
And one to mark in. And I still do that sometimes so that I have one that I can photocopy for teaching, but that's a different thing.
Right.
Now I just like, to hell with it. And, even valuable books, I do terrible things to.
Ah, I wouldn't say that. So by now, at this point, we've been talking for half an hour or a little more, and you've mentioned Emily Dickinson, you mentioned Olson, and these are also authors you've done work with. Oh, I didn't mention in your, I think significant work in that I didn't mention in your intro bio. So some of you who know Ben know that he edited the collected Olson, right?
Well, with Donald Allen, we edited the collected prose.
And you've done a bunch of research on Charles Olson. And something you started maybe as far back as grad school was working on Emily Dickinson in the Civil War. Is that right?
Right. That was my dissertation. And I'm still at work on that as a book.
Right. So have you returned to it? Because I had the sense that you may have put it aside for a while and then...
I mean, it's just perpetually interrupted work. The Dickinson is really life's work because, I had this intuition as an undergraduate working a night job at a Xerox shop reading Emily Dickinson and looking at the dates her poems were written, in a flash, this feeling that they pertained in this potent and indirect way to the Civil War. And, I'm talking about like 1984, 1985, so... The turning point in terms of, and at this point, that's almost like a cliche that Dickinson is a Civil War poet. She's now in the anthologies of Civil War poetry. And, if you go to the website of the Dickinson Museum, they'll have a page about that. And it's been a sea change from the mid 80s to this point, because right at that moment that I had this flash of insight, The turning point in Dickinson studies were these two books, one by Shira Wolosky on Dickinson and the Civil War, and then another book by Barton Levi St. Armand that was about Dickinson and the culture of mourning that had an important chapter on the Civil War. And those both were published in 1986, and from that has, developed there have been other changes in the culture and in scholarship that also contributed to this reappreciation of Dickinson as a poet of history in a way that, books published in the 70s would say there's no history at all in her poetry, which seems kind of crazy now, but that was the standard view. And I felt a connection with Dickinson in part because of that, because my father was a Holocaust survivor. And I think that it was partly my understanding of how experiences like war are registered in ways that are not necessarily manifest through direct, explicit description that made me sensitive to that aspect of her work. And I think that most of the people who were recognizing the Civil War in Dickinson's work prior to that moment came from similar backgrounds. There was an essay published in the 50s by someone who was in the military and teaching at one of the military colleges, I think during World War II, wrote an essay on Dickinson and the war. An early biography of Dickinson by Genevieve Taggart, an unjustly forgotten poet who was connected with New Masses and doing political work. And
I know Genevieve Taggart. She actually released a couple of albums.
Really?
Yes, I'm almost certain. I've heard them.
I would love to hear those.
Vermont?
That I don't know. I know that she was connected with New Masses, and she published this biography in the 20s, I think, that had a chapter on Dickinson and the Civil War, which, was completely forgotten until, I guess it's still forgotten. So I think although I've never talked to Wolosky about this, I suspect that Shira Wolosky also has some kind of background in the Holocaust because of... I guess speculation on my part. But in any case, I think that people who have had some connection, even vicarious as mine was, to those kinds of traumas, appreciates the ways in which those things sort of bubble under the surface in her work. So it goes way back for me. And then it was my dissertation. And it just continually, I certainly felt early on that I didn't quite have the tools to write about the work in the way that I wanted to. And that's one reason why it's gestated for a long time. But also I just keep getting opportunities that I can't say no to that interrupt it. You know, editing Charles Wilson diverted me from my dissertation for a year. When it was time for me to publish a book for tenure, which would have naturally been my dissertation, Charles Bernstein gave me the opportunity to publish with Alabama the book that became simulcast, that came out of the work that we were doing for Descriptions of an Imaginary Universe, which is hilarious because that was work that we were doing.
Academic, yeah. Right.
We were supposed to be working on our dissertations, and instead we were doing this foolishness, and then it ends up being my tenure book, which is probably more a measure of how academia has changed than anything else. But so it just keeps getting interrupted. And just recently, you know, I set it aside for a year to finish this book that I've edited with Ron Silliman, Allison Fraser, and Jeffrey Julich of the Collected Poems of David Melnick, which Nightboat will be publishing next year. So,
fantastic.
You know, procrastination for sure, but I guess of a constructive sort, I hope.
Please get it done. I mean, I haven't read any of that material, and I know, but I've known of it for so long. So
it's a very long book. I mean, I have already 400 pages of text, so I don't even know who will publish a book so long. But I am nearing in. So it's seven chapters, and I'm finishing the sixth. So I do feel like it is coming to a close.
Well, you'll get there. It'll get there. Ben does have, by the way, I should remind listeners that today I'm with Ben Friedlander here on Poet Radio, and your interest in 19th century poetry kind of flies in the face of some of, you know, the new American poetry, the Eigner, the Olson, but that's interesting. We need to have, all of us, I think, should have such a span of diverse interests. But this book that has come up, we've mentioned a couple of times, the simulcast,
yeah.
Ben had embodied the spirit and the text of Edgar Allan Poe. So if you're interested in Edgar Allan Poe, what Edgar Allan Poe might have said about certain 20th century authors, American authors, just look up Edgar Allan, A-L-L-E-N.
No, I spelled it A-N.
Oh, you spelled it A, but you just didn't spell it the same as he did.
I did.
Oh, you did. But I always thought, this is the thing about memory.
Well, we might have misspelled it once or twice because, you know, we were sloppy.
I thought that was intentional.
No, it was, it was Eep. Eep himself.
Eep himself. At any rate, Ben very, very carefully went through the original Edgar Allan Poe's criticism and then refashioned it to fit into, you know, to address contemporary writers. And it was not Bernstein's gesture of offering to publish. It was not because really out of friendship. It was because it was actually very interesting and actually a very strong critical approach and something not done previously. So, I mean, it's worth taking a look at if you're looking interested in sort of like, I don't even know. I said earlier I qualified it as a punk gesture, and maybe there was some of that, but it was still very, like, yeah. A lot of punk was intellectually informed, and, you know, it was by the book in a way, in a certain type of way, literally in certain ways. So, and nobody remembers that the original Edgar Allan Poe was such a great critic. I mean,
it's probably because he wrote about mostly authors, almost entirely authors who have been completely forgotten, which makes it difficult to sustain an interest in what he's doing because he really pays minute attention to the text. That was partly how I started doing these rewritings, because I was interested in the criticism, but to keep myself interested, I sort of would translate, you know, what he would say about, Fitzgreen Halleck, you know, by substituting Robert Duncan for Fitzgreen Halleck.
Right.
So, yeah, those were the days.
Good days also. So I'm hoping that you have some more of your own poems. I'd say we have 10 or so more minutes.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I've got lots of things here. Maybe I'll go back a little bit before the pandemic, read some. This is the first work that I did in the C-note form, and it was built up from the notes that I kept during that long period when I wasn't able to write. And it sort of retrospectively constructs a little bit of a narrative of that period. So I can read a couple of those. All right. Okay, this one is called Cognition is Its Own Discard. Putting its weight into action, into motion, first the days fade out, then memory, then memory's prompts, then we disappear into the same fog. Check. Broken nib of memory, there'll be no more signatures with this pen. What it means to ask what it means is what it means to ask what it means. Thought, a wind that disturbs pooled days. All facts are disputed. Their position is unfixed, liable to change of color, status, attachment to belief. I'm destitute of spontaneity, yielding to the will of others, the fact of having lived, tumbling into a crack of memory like a key dropped in confusion through a grate. If it gleams, you can be sure it wasn't lost that long ago. Gleaming or dull, it's scarcely worth the effort of being found. Dementia. If you hang out long enough in the nursing home, someone will eventually offer you dessert. The mind? An architecture in which levels cannot sufficiently differentiate stories. A dwindled source of will to live. Swell to a part at the seams. The tea is a golden pool cooling in stillness like a man in bed all day and night. Prayers fall from his lips. They never seem to rise. Square of sun crossed by shadow, gift of a window set at his feet. Like a face, the days are entirely outward. Their will retreats into involuntary functions. Pleasures, contentments, impediments. What limits can we set to implication? What is your mother's maiden name? What city were you born in? What is the name of your dog?
What is the name of the local airport?
Yeah.
Owl's Head. You were about a mile or so from the local airport.
Was that all right, or do you want me to read it again?
That's okay.
Okay.
It's a real.
Yeah.
Keeping it real on the coast of Maine. And also the poem with the dressing, aging.
All right.
Difficult stuff.
Here's that rainy day. A functional incapacity to think even a second ahead of my own actions, even when the second is past, receding far into the fog of never was. I forgot the emotion attached to those shapes. Only the colors remain in place of a story. Posteriority is a form whose content is to be the days don't run on time because there is no schedule free enough to fill. Fairy circles winding down. And so life became the illustration of a principle by which I act on impulse, understanding nothing. Here's that rainy day. Insulated, I conduct insulation for the wire that conducts tradition across a flammable expanse. Time softens and collapses like an apple in a pot over heat. A river, seed, lamp, wind, cloud. A colony collapse, not equal to anything that is equal. The merit has not decayed. The pea under the mattress that keeps me awake is the name I can't remember, the face I can't place. My scabies year. Scabies, I've learned, is something that you get especially in nursery schools and nursing homes. That's another one of the ways that extreme youth and extreme old age are brought together. My scabies year. The soft outer covering of vertebrates vibrates when thousands bore through in hard purpose. A living serration cut through sensation uncleanly. My skin's alive and scratches loudly. A scraping taken for testing continues to die apart from its host. With fingernails exacerbating circumstances notwithstanding, any heightened sense of pleasure radiates infection. The itching is terrible. Heat makes it worse. Yet I can stand in a hot shower 30 minutes, the sensation exquisite. Infinitesimal fecal matter glows in the scab all skin becomes after scratching. Those parts of us we cannot occupy or know where others have trod. My mind is a blank rage that fills with any capable noise. The master of a sense perception, a clutch of darkness. Scrubbing, I am the brush filled with the grit of any skin I touch. Like a dog who races into waves and yaps, racing back when the waves defy him, I dance into time and scream, but there is no dancing back. And maybe. Maybe one more. A period of mourning. Let each year swallow itself and be the purge of undigested nourishment. The hills of snow contract, become heavy. If I walk across the trees' shadows and look up, the sky is blinding. The icy driveway turns to slush, and I slip as I walk to the back door. The torn-out gas station, its tanks pulled up and the holes filled in. The cellophane crinkle of partially frozen puddles. A soft sweater that slips to the floor. Give me time. I will name everything that's past. Reasoning cuts through a multitude of sensations. Perplexity is a mode of apprehension neither here nor there. Numbness takes a feeling form. Like putting on a coat that's upside down, searching for an arm that isn't there. All voices come together to be noise. The still air tortured into movement by a song. Time opens a box that space closes. The day has a winter look, not cold but bare, rubbed raw by Earth's rotation. I part the universe with every step. It heals itself as instantly. Tasked with holding down the night with sleep, the day blew a gust of emptiness in my direction. Intentions matter, and like all matter, decay. All my thoughts are ajar, but my heart is closed, a screen door banging in wind, the wooden door sealed too.
The title that was again?
A Period of Mourning.
Yeah, yeah. Like, sort of comes through, not just sort of. Wow, Ben, great to hear these poems. And did you say that you have a book coming up or something?
Yeah, so this, so I have, after all this spell, I have two books. One is this work here, this first book of the C notes that are really the nursing home period, which Spuyten Duyvil is going to publish, mm-hmm. I guess, next year. It's called Some Cares. And then Mark Johnson's Hiding Press is going to publish a book of improvisations on Rosa Auslander, which are just, they're silly sort of nonsense-like poems that I, again, a totally arbitrary constraint, which is that I take the first letter of each line of one of her poems and I write, you know, with the same, so like an acrostic, with the same letter. And sometimes I will play off of the German words, but not really. And so, I mean, I could read one or two of those if you...
Well, we're about to end the show, and I think that would probably be a good one. I knew that you were using the Auslander work for your own poems. I just had that sense, or maybe you mentioned it in passing or something. But at any rate, we are coming to the end of this month's Poet Radio. My guest has been Ben Friedlander, who's a professor at University of Maine, and so glad that we were able to get together here in Maine. And we'll finish the show with a couple of last poems of Ben's riffing off of Rose.
Yeah. In fact, I think the book is called Briefing from Rose. This is one, Chris, will maybe amuse you. It's called What It Is. Desolate smell of old music. Vinyl in its sleeve, organized under dust. It is a winter's nostril, does the listening. I take you out, zero grooved with sound. Don't play you, only weigh you silently.
Vintage vinyl.
Yeah.
It's moldy oldie.
So they're like, you know, the same length as Rose's work. Should shoulder be bent willfully to wheel as wheel would be inclined to hill. No wheel could let it down. Melancholy. Melancholy denies seeking out such men, denies seeking out such women as might yield light. Melancholy seeks out light devoid of hims or hers who, so devoid of heaven are, an earth might well be the hell they fell to. I like the improvisation part only in the sense that, you know, because of the acrostic form, I just like use vocabulary I would never have thought to include in a poem. Which then leads to formulations I would have never thought of on my own. So it's almost like collage in that way. Frege. Words mix with time. I seek mine geometrically in hope they will measure ground. Geometry grown from a seed. Holding out hope on its branch like a leaf means to let hope shrivel and fall, golden but dead returning to ground. Zone where all measures crunch light. And one last one. Woke. Woke didn't begin as jargon, didn't end there. Seize up, kink this limb, halter this top, kiss the mouth, vomiting sea and salt.
Yeah, with that we conclude Poet Radio, August 2022 with Ben Friedlander.